This is Common Ground, a program on world affairs and the people who shape events.
I do think that we face a totally extraordinary shift, that this change from the industrial era to the compassionate era means that the human race grows up or doesn't make it. That one of the rhetorics you hear these days is it's a sort of final exam. Is the human race capable of being mature, or are we just adolescents and we've blown it?
Finding hope and possibility as we turn the century. A conversation with futurist Robert Theobald on this edition of Common Ground. Common Ground is produced by the Stanley Foundation. I'm Mary Gray Davidson. If you think too hard about the problems in the world, the situation may appear hopeless. But futurist Robert Theobald refuses to give in to the second part of that equation, the sense of hopelessness. He sees great possibility for humanity as we move into the 21st century. Theobald has been grappling with the problems of the world ever since he left post-World War II Europe and settled here in the United States. He's written often about how to manage our global problems, beginning in 1964 with the book The Triple Revolution. His other books include The Rapids of Change, Beyond Despair, and now his latest, published in 1992, titled Turning the Century. I asked Robert Theobald whether the fundamental issues have changed in the past half century.
You know, it's fascinating because I'm not sure that the fundamental issues have changed much since I started working in the 50s. What's happened is that the trends we saw coming have continued. We decided that we were going to solve all the world's problems by consumption, by entertainment, by giving people more and more money, by looking at the quantity of goods. And I think we found out it didn't work. I think we found out that basically unless you treat people as people, unless you care for people, unless you care for the environment, you're going to get into deep trouble. I think where we now are in the 90s is that we're just beginning to recognize how deep trouble we're in, and the question which we're facing is, are we willing to recognize that, and then are we willing not to get so frightened by it that we say it's hopeless, which is easy at the moment, but to say, hey, we can change that. We created it. We can change it. It won't be simple, but we must change it. I think the big thing that is changing is the sense that people now have that we have a very short time left to come to grips with these issues, and if we don't, the world is going to be a less and less safe, less and less secure place.
I found your analysis in Turning the Century, your analysis of the past four decades, to be really interesting, that the way you labeled from the 60s idealism. What was the progression after this?
Well,
this 60s?
You had the 60s idealism, and I was in that a lot, and I thought we were making changes, and I've since decided we were what I call the clowns of the culture. It was fun to listen to the crazies. The 70s were deeply pessimistic. It was really set by the Club of Rome's report, which some of the listeners will know about, which was a report about how we needed to move towards sustainability, how we needed to change the culture. But they carried an unintended note, which was it was hopeless, that nothing could be done. Carter came along and tried to get the country to look at this, and then there was a competition between Carter and Reagan, and the assumption was that there really was a battle, but my belief is that that was the election in 1980. It wasn't about that at all. It was about the hostages. So long as the hostages were still in Iran, nobody could have won. So Reagan won, and then he sort of gave us a last hurrah. He said, I'm going to make everything work. You can be rich. Everything will be fine. And they really were the decade of greed. They were the decade in which we justified grabbing, looking at everything we could get. And now we're in the 90s, and what I find is that they feel very like the 60s in one way, that we started the 60s slow, that there wasn't much going on. And as I see the 90s developing, more and more people are saying, either we do something, or it's going to get much worse. And I'm seeing it in my own home community of New Orleans, where we've got really two extraordinary trends running at the moment. One of the trends is towards clearly a much less safe, attractive city. And then on the other hand, an extraordinarily large group of people who are saying, we can change this.
You say in the book, Turning the Century, that we're in the eye of the hurricane. Do you see it as a moment with some breathing space, some opportunity before some real cataclysmic events hit?
Well, the eye of the hurricane was an interesting... I hadn't thought of it that way, because I was using the eye of the hurricane in the fact that when you go into the eye, the winds blow from one side. And we've had very strong winds pushing us towards economic growth, towards pushing us towards maximum employment for everybody. All sorts of things which we've taken for granted. And I think we're going to come out on the other side and we're going to say, look, there are a lot of women who are now saying, women and men, who are saying, I want to stay home and raise my kids. Why do we believe that everybody ought to have a job? Can't we go back to a culture in which people who want, parents who want to stay home and raise their kid, or at least one of the parents, can do that? I think we're going to have more and more people, and you're seeing this, one of the movements I'm associated with is the movement towards thrift, where people are saying, I'm not going to get caught up in this consumption racket. I'm going to, in a sense, buy less, consume less, and have more time. People are saying, I want time in my life. And I think we're going to see a new set of winds coming along which will sweep us in a new direction. And I think there's an appearance of calm. I think people... sort of, it doesn't seem as if much is happening, but I believe that we're very close to coming out on the other side of the hurricane at the moment.
Well, just in case you're not preaching to the choir right now, and there are people out there who aren't familiar with the some specific challenges, would you go over some of those major issues that you think that we're not dealing with effectively? You did mention the economic structure.
Well, you see, it's interesting because I think you talked at the beginning about what's the major change. I don't think you need to convince people we have problems. I think that's our biggest mistake as change agents. We go in and we say to people, look, you don't understand how bad things are. And if they're honest with you, they say, look, we know perfectly well. We don't need to know about 10 other crises. We're aware that things aren't working. I do a thing called the Titanic Quiz. And it shows that nearly everybody has a sense that something is deeply wrong with the culture in which we're living. Now, those are different things. But just to be very quick, we have a culture in which we cannot generate good jobs for kids. The unemployment rate, if you're in a small town, you say, well, our kids leave and they go to New York and they go to New Orleans. And we assume when they get there, they get jobs. The fact is they don't. The unemployment rate for teenagers is 50% in New York. And in the other major cities. They're not going to get good jobs. There was an extraordinary figure that just came out which showed that the median income for people in their mid-40s and 50s has dropped by about 20% over the last 5 years. Now, that's an incredible figure. So you've got a huge economic shift going on. You have millions of people, millions of well-trained, well-educated people who are being told there's no place for them in the culture. So you've got kids who have no place to go and who are saying, what do I do with my life? No reason for hope. Joining a gang and having kids as teenagers are, if you like, rational responses to that. They're not good responses for the culture, but if I'm an individual with no hope and nowhere to go, if I'm a female and have a kid, the culture says, well, we've got to look after you and we've got to look after the kid. If I'm a male, that gives me some sense of companionship, some sense of something to do. So that's one whole very frightening area. Another frightening area is the fact that if you look at the health crisis, we have this discussion going on with President Clinton being unwilling to level with us on the only real crucial, I shouldn't say the only, but one crucial issue is health care will mean rationing. What we're talking about is who gets what health care, not how does everybody get first-class health care. It's impossible. There are not enough resources to provide everybody with first-class health care. We're going to have to make choices. I've just talked inside. and I don't want to spend much more time on it, but just let's look outside for one moment. The situation in Africa is just incredible. Many of your readers may have seen a piece in the Atlantic Monthly about February. That's what the world is really like in Africa. It's going to take much more courage, much more guts, much more imagination, and much more wisdom than we're showing if we are not going to see the rest of the world crumble. And I don't think the developed world can stand out against that. He uses a very fascinating analogy. He says, we're going to be in a stretch limo in the middle of the slums. Well, I don't want to be in a stretch limo in the middle of the slums. I don't think it's very safe, and I don't think the world will be safe unless we come to grips with those issues.
And so what you're saying is that it's not the fact that there's a lack of knowledge about the problems, it's people's way of responding to the problems that you're dealing with.
I think the problem is that this has become so overwhelming to people that they say, look, if it's this bad, this complex, what's the point of trying? Why don't I just live out my life the best I can? I'm going to have a few luxuries. I'm going to do the things I want to. It's not going to make any difference. And I think what we have to teach people, enable people to see, is that you don't have to solve the world's problems. You can do something local that makes a difference. And that if you do something local, something small, which moves us towards a more compassionate society, just possibly all of this added together will make a difference.
Well, it's interesting because there are people who are disenfranchised at all levels of society, and I'm wondering, how do you take people, you know, you had used the example of kids in inner cities who are so disenfranchised, how do you go about making them feel that they have some control over their lives and that what they do can make a positive difference?
Well, I think there are two levels. First, I've got a lovely story just by chance on this. We ran a group in New Orleans this fall where we put together a judge in the appellate court and the principal of one of the worst schools in one of the worst areas in the city. And the connection has made all sorts of things happen in that school which couldn't have been done through the institutional and bureaucratic systems. It works because the principal of that school, Fisher Elementary School, is somebody who cares deeply about her kids. She's parent, she's grandparent, she's teacher, she's principal, etc., etc. So you can do that much. You can make the school a safe haven. And I mean that quite literally because they have to have bullet drills. They have gun drills. When shooting starts, they're told to get under the desk. This is the country in 1994, a country where elementary school kids know how to react to gunfire in their schools. So there's that. You can do something about that. But we cannot do anything about the total problem until we as a society are willing to ask some fundamental questions about what people's lives are going to be like in a world when you have automation and cybernation and a surplus labor force. What's purpose going to be? What's work going to be? How do people get resources? And if we continue what we continue to say, I get so angry, people say, if everybody had a good job, we wouldn't have problems. It's a great statement. It means absolutely nothing because everybody is not going to have a good job in the sense that we understood it. We've got to get into the idea of being creative about what is work. But I've already answered part of that. If a parent, male or female, says, we would like to raise our kids well, we as a society today can afford to let them do that. So we need to begin to think about what is meaningful work in the 21st century, and parenting is certainly a piece of that. It's parenting is hard work.
You're listening to Common Ground. It's a service of the Stanley Foundation. My guest is futurist and author Robert Theobald. His latest book is titled Turning the Century, published in 1992 by Knowledge Systems Incorporated. The Stanley Foundation is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that conducts a wide range of programs meant to provoke thought and encourage dialogue on world affairs. Printed transcripts and audio cassettes of this program are available. Please listen at the end of this broadcast for details. Well, do you find or do you believe that most people do want to do something about these problems, or has it not yet reached a critical mass of people?
I think that people are going back to being, wanting to be citizens. We really did create a culture in which we said your greatest responsibility is to be a consumer. I mean, it's fascinating. You know, you read the paper and they said, you know, it's almost, did you go out and buy this week? And if you didn't, you're a real bum.
Mm-hmm.
And
it starts at the youngest ages.
Starts at the youngest ages. We have made consumption the centerpiece of being a good American. And this is not going to work. I think a surprising number of people are back to saying, I want to be a citizen. The problem is there are very few spaces in our culture for good citizenship. Yeah, you can vote, but that really isn't it. We need spaces where people can get into the system and help to create a high quality of life. But it's tied to a much bigger question. We have run a culture in which we have said to people, we expect you to be a bum, we expect you to be a cheat. All of our systems are set up on the assumption that if you leave people alone, they will do dreadful things. I believe, on the contrary, that most people, most of the time, want to develop themselves, help other people, be responsible. Most people, most of the time. Not all people, all of the time. We need a new cultural system which encourages people to do good rather than concentrates on preventing them from doing evil.
So how do we tap into that good side of people's nature?
Well, I think that the challenge for those people who are ready is to find places where people can have the conversation we're having. There's really no place in most communities where you can go and talk about these issues, perhaps less than there's ever been. There's so many. We've now got PC. You've got to be terribly careful what you say. And this requires us to be able to say the things we think, believe in, care about, and for somebody to say, yeah, I understand you feel that way, but I disagree with you. It needs to be a place where black and white and Hispanics and Asians and men and women and young and old can have safe space, and you can say, yeah, I know you mean that, but it doesn't seem to me that's right. So I think that's, for me, that's the primary necessity, and that's the work I'm doing in New Orleans, and the work I do across the country is working with communities to help them to find out how they can make a step in that direction.
Clearly, in your thinking, community is the direction that we have to be moving, and you don't seem to have much faith in our current institutions leading the way.
You're quite right. I believe in community, but I think we have three types of community. I think they're work communities, I think they're professional communities, and I think there's geographical community. I believe that our institutions are almost forced to be hierarchical. They're almost forced to rely on power. It's about the only thing we understand. It's extraordinarily difficult to shift them into a non-power model. It is even more difficult to get Westerners to understand that we're not talking about moving from power to total lack of any discrimination. In other words, what we tend to say is either we have a power model or everybody is equal. I mean, everybody who's listening will have heard the rhetoric about, well, we go to total subjectivity, there's no way of making judgments. Now, that's not what I'm talking about at all. You get judgments in terms of wisdom. And people can see wisdom. One of the points I make in my work is that there are no experts, but there are high skills. And some people have skills, can pass those skills on. And what we need is a culture based on skills and to recognize that some people are skilled at some things and some people are skilled at other things. And to learn what you're skilled at is real crucial to one's ability to do anything. And what you're not skilled at.
I think most people agree that we're in a post-industrial era, and they're searching or grappling with what the next era will be, and generally it's based in economic terms. And what I liked in your work is that you're not looking at this new era and searching for what the next economic solution will be, but you've chosen to call it the compassionate era.
Well, I think that's right. You see, What most people are doing is underestimating, from my perspective, the extent of the shift. When you move from hunting and gathering to agriculture, it was very slow, but there was an enormous change. You really did have a very flat society in hunting and gathering. In agriculture, you went to priests and kings. You couldn't have anticipated the agricultural era from the hunting and gathering era. We didn't anticipate from agriculture to industry what the change was. And I don't think most people are understanding that economics is not the driver for this change. It is only as we look at a new set of indicators, which I call the quality of life, and you can also add environmental sustainability. How do you produce a high quality of life for everybody on the planet? Because you can't leave people out, in my mind, with economic sustainability, with environmental sustainability. Now, people have to be fed, and they have to be clothed, and they have to be sheltered. But the problem is not economics. The problem hasn't been economics for a long time. Production isn't the issue. Distribution of resources and who gets what has been the issue for a long time. And we tried to resolve that by saying, well, everybody can consume as much as they like. And now we say, but we can't do that because the environment out there isn't going to sustain what we're throwing at it.
Back on that issue of compassion, it seems that there are quite a few authors writing about the need for compassion with ourselves and with our communities. Is compassion, do you think, something we as a species have lacked all along, or did we lose it somewhere along the way?
First we ought to talk about what we mean by compassion. It can be a very weak word. I use it in the sense of compassion, with caring, with... This is not a weak word for me. This is not just caring for the weak and the sick. It's being passionate about the society in which you live. And that means that you have to do three things. Sometimes you have to tell the people you can do better than you're doing. Sometimes you have to say to people, yes, indeed, you've had a lousy day and we'll help you. And sometimes you have to say, we've got a lousy system and it doesn't work and we'll change. So it's not just, it's not a weak word. We've got four people who we need to be caring for. I do think that we face a totally extraordinary shift, that this change from the industrial era to the compassionate era means that the human race grows up or doesn't make it. That one of the rhetorics you hear these days is it's a sort of final exam. Is the human race capable of being mature, or are we just adolescents and we've blown it? And I think that that is what is so new. There was a line in the Whole Earth Catalog, which some of my listeners will certainly remember, we are as gods and we better get good at it. And I think that's right. We will have to play a number of roles which have been played by the gods in the past. And are we willing, are we capable of operating at that level is the question we have to face up to.
One of the themes that I pick up on in a lot of your work is not giving in to despair. And I was wondering if you'd talk about that a little bit.
Well, one of my titles a long time ago was Beyond Despair, and it came out of a comment that somebody made. I titled the book Reasons for Hope, and they said that's too simple. And I think they were right, and it really is tied into my statement. We must be realistic. You're not going to solve anything by pretending that you don't have the problems we clearly have. So your first step is to say, this is what the situation is. Take your own community. What's really going on? What do we have to face up to? Because, for example, we're not going to solve the drug issue the way we're trying to solve it. Everybody knows it, but we keep on pretending we are. We need to look at it face on and say, okay, this strategy hasn't worked. What alternatives are there? We've got to be realists, so that's the first thing. So we've got to move beyond despair, because if you look at that realistically, it's very easy to get caught in that. So the second thing is to say, courageous realism. In other words, I can do something about this. Not all of it, but I can take a piece of this. I can take my neighborhood. Nice story again out of New Orleans. There's a church which is buying houses strategically and driving the crack dealers out because the houses are held by responsible people, many of whom have been in the crack business themselves and have got through it and come out on the other side and therefore know what the culture is and can deal with it. And then the third thing, as I say, is not to try and do it all. To say, if I can save one life, or I can help one kid, or I can be creative in something, that's enough, because you don't know what it does. You know, there's that old story that teachers always have. They don't know who they help.
You know, that theme of maybe helping one individual is a very old religious theme, too, in most major religions. And it's, you know, I think it's the Midrash that says if you save one soul, you save all of humanity.
The most remarkable thing, I think, is that we are at a point where the presumed clash between social science and religion is absolutely nonsense. That the most advanced theologians and the most advanced system thinkers or people thinking secularly are coming out with exactly the same conclusions. And that what we know from religion, if we would take it seriously, is exactly what we want ought to be doing. The problem is that there are not many churches that are preaching religion. And until we are willing, in a sense, to go back and look at the deep traditions of religion, not how it has been cheapened, we're not really going to get it. But you're absolutely right. There's nothing new about this. And some of my friends quite correctly say I'm just a secular preacher.
Well, we should finish up, and I wanted to leave our listeners with some action that they could take. And I know you talk about networking with creative people. How do you go about doing that?
Well, I think that the only thing you can say generically is find some people who you can talk to about these issues. And to the maximum possible extent, find them diverse. I'd also recommend some reading, not much, because most of it doesn't help very much. I tried in Turning the Century and a previous book called The Rapids of Change to provide people with some very basic down-to-earth stuff on what's happening. And the third thing is to start working in community. There are a number of people, including myself, who are really have some tools and some skills and some models to help communities work on their stuff if they decide to do so. So, but the first thing for all of us is to get clearer about our own willingness to commit to being citizens or to being spiritual beings, which is another way of saying the same thing.
Futurist Robert Theobald has been my guest on Common Ground. His latest book, published by Knowledge Systems Incorporated, is titled Turning the Century. I'm Mary Gray Davidson. If you'd like to order a printed transcript or audio cassette of this Common Ground program, contact Journal Graphics at 1-800-824-5746. Ask for program number 9417. If you'd like more information about the Stanley Foundation, or you have some comments about the program, please write to us at 216 Sycamore Street, Muscatine, Iowa, 52761. Again, to purchase transcripts or audio cassettes, call Journal Graphics at 1-800-825-5746 and ask for program number 9417. Our theme music was created by B.J. Lederman. Common Ground was produced and funded by the Stanley Foundation.